Bill, would you be able to help us out here?
Yeah, you know, Jim was giving such an amazing invitation to our speaker, and I hate to step on him, but hey, to fill in here. Our speaker tonight is a regular at a great number of meetings in the local area. Matt has been sober, I believe it's 17 years, he is going to rock our boots, I'm sure, tonight. Or maybe he'll just inspire us. But anyway, hey, Matt, thanks for being here tonight. Please take it away.
Thank you very much. Everybody hear me? Hear me loud and clear? Good. Come here. My name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic. And if things don't go my way, I don't like it. And when things weren't going my way, I drank it. And that was just about every day. Because life is difficult. I look for things to share about today. And every time, well, almost every time, I studied up on something, there came into my heart a reason not to share about it. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there in my studies today, there have been two examples that I've found. I'm sure we've done more of this, where we have taken adversity and used, if you will, technology to help us. When the COVID thing hit, of course, this is current times, current events. When the COVID thing started to spread across the pandemic around the world, we maintained our fellowship through technological means, through Zoom and through telephone, and we got together personally. And the thing is, we overcame like a bunch of Marines that I know. Adapted, overcame, and improvised. And we have that to share with the people who come behind us. And this is very important to me. There was another time in AA's history. And I just love the history of AA. I'm reading about it today. There was back in the early days, before there were even three AA groups, there was Akron and New York. And I don't remember who took care of which one, but Bill took care of one, and Bob took care of the other. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was growing. And in 1944, I think it was, the Cleveland group started. And there was a baseball player named Raleigh Hensley. And when I read that today, the program language comes to me. Attraction rather than promotion. And this guy, Raleigh Hensley, he was a famous outfielder for the Cleveland Indians. And we have to remember that the World War II was in full rage, and America was really into escapism. We had the movies, we had radio, we had baseball, the World Series was huge, horse racing was huge, fashion was huge. And we were rationed down to precious things, and baseball was one of the precious things we had left. Raleigh Hensley made a statement in a paper that he is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and it's changing his life for the better. And what happened was, in a short amount of time, the fellowship of Cleveland AA exploded. The walls of AA bulged with new infusion. People who wanted a better life. People who wanted to be like Raleigh. People who wanted to be athletic and happy and joyous and free. And what happened was, news of this event got back to Bill and Bob, and they appointed people who were in charge of the new Cleveland meetings. And by the way, the book was brand new. So they picked some people to take groups of 10 people into another room and asked them 20 questions. There is some thought that this is where the 20 questions come from. The newcomers, you'll find those later on. And these trusted servants asked the 20 questions of the assembled 10 people around each table. And if one person answered four or more, no, you're excused. We suggest you find a church or therapy or join the military or whatever. You're clearly not an alcoholic, and this program is not for you. It's for people who need to do it. And so that's the genesis of sponsorship. These people were called sponsors. And AA took that idea and took that development, and it became sponsorship as we know it today. And in the 40s, from 1944 to 1955, AA had 50 to 75% success rate. Half of us survived. And there is an article in one of the grapevines from 1961, Bill W. said, and I could pull it up. It's on my Kindle pad. But I'll paraphrase. And he said, clearly, 500,000 people have recovered from the deadly malady. And for every one that has recovered, there are at least two. Because we see an influx of people, and the people come in and they leave. Some people come in and they leave. And the ones that stay, 50 to 75% stay and get it and go on to a better life. And he said that at least 1 million people have missed out on the program, have been in the program, turned around and left under their own power. And he blamed sponsorship. He said ineffective sponsorship. Well, in the time since the 50s, we've taken sponsorship to a whole new level. In those days, when the sponsorship was developed, it had five jobs. One, you answer questions of the newcomer. Two, you guide the newcomer through the meeting. This is a closed meeting, or this is a speaker meeting, or this is a share meeting. Or you give your first name and your first initial of your last name, that's all, then you sit back down. Time for you to hush. Time for you to listen. So there's guide, there's answer questions. There is facilitate the big book, a pad of paper, a pencil, and a phone list to the newcomer. The third is to be a confidant and to hear things that the newcomer wouldn't necessarily share in the meeting, that they might be able to share privately. And four, five, most importantly, you'll pray with the newcomer. Those are the five functions of a sponsor. It isn't to hear the fourth step, because the fifth step doesn't say, admit to God, to myself and my sponsor, the exact nature of my wrong. It doesn't say that. It says another human being. This can be a pastor. It can be a dentist. It can be a neighbor. It can be a confidant. It can be your sponsor. Just somebody you trust. Somebody who you know your news and your story isn't going to go further than that person's ears. So, with that, that's what I studied up on today. Sponsorship and how we've taken it and developed it without committee, without convention, how we've taken it and we've adapted, improvised, and overcame. So that's my share about COVID and sponsorship. Now, I have about a half an hour to go. I'm going to tell you the story of my first AA meeting. Put your hand down if you've heard it. I was 24 years old and at home at my mother's house, drinking pretty heavily. My alcoholism was developing, and I was drinking with impunity. I had little regard for consequences, and I was pretty unemployable, and I was just a mess. And a family friend came over, a dear, loved, beloved, trusted family friend. Her name was Joan, and she came over and knocked on the door. I opened the door and said, "Hi, Joanina. Mom's not here." She said, "I know. Your mother's at work." Joan and my mother worked together. She said, "You're the one I want to talk to." I said, well, you better come in then. And we sat down, and she had a gift for me. She said, "I want to give you this book. This is the very book. See, it's marked, and if I were to open it, it's inscribed and all that good stuff." And she said, "Now, Matt, I want to talk to you honestly about something, and I want you to know that I love your family, and I love you, and I hope you love me too." And I said, "Yeah, Joan, what's going on? Mom okay?" She said, yeah, your mother's fine. She said, "Matt, I see something happening with you at 24 tender years of age that causes me great concern." And I said, "What's that, Joanie?" She said, I see you becoming a drinking alcoholic. Sounds like she knows a little bit what she's talking about. I said, I think you're right, Joan. And she said, that's amazing to me. If you do what I say, if you follow my instructions, you will learn how important the first half of the first step you just took when you admitted you're an alcoholic to me. You'll come to learn how profoundly important that is. And so before I'd ever even cracked the book or learned anything or learned any of the terminology, I'd already done the first half of the first step. So this has been, since my 24th year, something I've been involved in and thought about. And she said, I'm going to give you some instructions, and I'm going to give you this book, and I want you to follow them. I said, okay. And she looked at me very seriously. She said, am I being heard? I said, yeah, Joni. She said, because your ass is on the line. You're in trouble. Oh, wow. So, and I didn't realize that deadly the malady is. I've learned this since from personal experience and through personal testimony. So she gave me some instructions, and she said, I want you at 11 o'clock tomorrow to go to a place called the Alano. And I want you to park in the southwesterlymost parking stall. And I want you to grab this book, and I want you to crack this book, and I want you to start reading, and I want you to read for 45 minutes. And she front-loaded me beautifully. She said, you're not going to understand what you're reading. This book was written in a language we don't speak anymore. It's in English, but uses terminology that's from days gone by. And I said, okay, she said, but just take in the words. They will make sense later on. They will take on other forms for you later on, and you'll begin to understand them in different ways as the years go on. I haven't even made my first meeting or read my first page. This is how she's front-loading me. This book is going to become different to you, and you're going to learn different things from it as your life as a sober person progresses. Wow. In love. Wasn't that nuts from a judge, and nobody wrung their hands and said, Daddy or Matt, please, no more. This is a family friend. He said, you're going to do what I tell you because your ass is in trouble. So I went to the Alano, and it was just as she said. She said, you're going to go in there and you're going to meet some really nice people. And you're either going to sit in a big circle or you're going to sit at tables, and you're going to convene. You're going to come together in prayer. You're going to talk about matters spiritual, she said, hopefully. See how profound an experience this is? I remember it like it was yesterday. This is how big AA and recovery is in my life. My introduction is like it just happened. And she said, you're going to meet a lot of people, and you're going to be very, very nice people, and you're going to convene in prayer, you're going to talk about matters spiritual, and you're going to adjourn in prayer. And then she said, Matt, I want you to remember something very important here. In your brain, during this first meeting, your head is going to say, this is different, I'm different. You guys are that, and I'm this. That's your club, this is your program, and I can still control and enjoy my drinking. I've still got a handle on this. It's the great obsession of every known alcoholic to think he will control and enjoy his drinking. That split for me when I was 17. But the point is, she's telling me that you're going to hear things that you're going to want to separate from. You're going to say, I'm different. She said, listen for a similarity. And when you hear a similarity, hang on to it. And she said, at this meeting, hang on to that similarity and grab a question. In your head, you're going to have a million questions going around because you have the brain of an alcoholic. You think a million miles an hour in a 200-mile-an-hour world. So grab a question and grab this behavior and this belief that you're the same, this idea. And it was just as if she had transported me there, because when I went the next day, I parked, I read. Oh, man, I don't get any of this at all. What's going on? Oh, no, what's this? I've adjusted my rearview mirror. Oh, they're going in. Okay, so I went in. And there's some really, really nice people that smiles and laughing and jovial. And I didn't get. I'm there because I got my tail between my legs, because I'm in trouble. Because a family friend came and said, your ass is in trouble, Brogan. So I'm there in an AA meeting. And my brain does exactly, and we read 12 things over here, these are called the steps, and I didn't understand them, And Joan told me, you're going to read 12 things over here. You're not going to get it. Don't worry about it. We're just getting you started. Oh, okay, I accepted those. I don't get any of that. And then we read 12 things over here. Turns out those are the traditions. And Joan told me, you're going to read 12 things over here. You're not going to understand them. You're really not going to get those. But don't worry about it. We're just getting you started. Just get into it. Be willing to get into it. I went, okay, all right. So just like she said, we read 12 things, French. We read 12 things over here. Now those are German. And so we convened this meeting with Kumbaya or something like that. I don't remember the prayer. The sinus infection prayer. What is it? Serenity prayer. Oh, sorry. So this is my first meeting. And I'm listening, and of course my brain goes, that's you guys, this is me, I'm different, I can control and enjoy my drinking. Even though I'm there in trouble, my brain takes over. I have the mind of an alcoholic. And it took over. And as luck would have it, a woman, somebody couldn't be more different than me. It turns out she was an African woman. She said, when I try to control my drinking, I can't enjoy it. And when I try to enjoy my drinking, I can't control it. And I knew exactly what she meant. She didn't have to explain, but she went on to explain to other newcomers that when she tries to enjoy her drinking, there's no control, there's no off switch. She drinks everything in sight. She drinks yours, and then she wakes up in trouble, comes to in trouble. When she tries to control her drinking, it's no fun. And I've understood. And I remember in my teens and my early 20s doing this with a beer. And somebody would say, Matt, want another beer? Want another? No, thanks, man. No, I'm nursing. Do I look like I'm having a good time? No! I'm over here standing in the corner with my hand over my suds. Get it? So when I tried to control my drinking, I couldn't enjoy it. When I tried to enjoy it, I couldn't control it. And this woman, this black lady, and I just went, in my head and my heart, her information made the 2-foot drop. And I knew I was in the right place. I knew Joan was right. I knew I admitted the right thing the day before. And I knew I was listening to people who were telling my story. Man, what a profoundly moving experience in my life. Did I stay? No. Because my brain took over and I became rebellious and my self-will took over. And my leaving there, all that did was start a 10-year process. Insert the Jeopardy theme here, whereby I ended up right back at the Alano. A 10-year process. And what did I see there? I went to a night meeting and I saw some guy pounding on the podium. And you got to get the 164, get a cup of coffee, get a chip, get a book, get a sponsor, get a towel. This is gonna get real. And I just went, wow, I'm out of here. This guy's crazy. Oh, Larry, he's beating up the furniture. And all that did, when I left, it started a 10-year process by which I just ended up right back there at the Alano. And this time I was willing to listen. And a friend of mine said, you should know some people there by now. You should have at least made some friends. This is 20 years. And after a meeting, once, I was sitting there, dejected, tail between my legs, arrows in my mind. And I was just, the meeting was done and everybody was gone and somebody came over to me. And if you stay in the program, this local program, you'll find them. And he asked me, pretty overwhelming, isn't it? I said, yeah. And I asked him to sit down and I asked him, how long do I have to come here? And he said, well, it was as long as you want. His answer was eloquent. His answer was thought. His answer was not stand me up and put me against the wall and put a finger in my chest and say, do you know what you are? You're a liar. You're a sinner. It wasn't anything like that. It was not degrading. He said, look, man, you can come back here as often as long as you want to. This door is always open to you. And I've always felt that about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always felt a very strong kinship to the fellowship and And there are people who have moved, whom I miss, and people who have passed, whom I miss. It is a family. I can't tell you how grateful I am, and that's an often used word. It's an inner, for me, the gratitude goes deeper than just the words or expressing them. But when I left rehab the second time, I was well and truly done with meetings. I was done with rehab meetings because I was hearing the same stories, hearing the same thing over and over and over again. The same nine guys were embellishing their stories a little bit of honesty was leaving, a little bit of creativity was coming in. And I thought, in my head, my alcoholic head, thought, this is AA, this is what I'm going to face when I leave. And when I left the rehab, I didn't go to another meeting. Well, I'd lost sight of the fact that outside meetings are not rehab meetings. They're different styles. They're different personnel. So I want to emphasize, I want to impress upon the residents of the recovery homes. First off, I love you. I'm from there. I did rehab twice. But the outside meetings are different. The outside meetings are the aftercare. So continue on with the meeting. And in 2005, I left the rehab and I didn't make a meeting. And I don't advise this. Don't do this because it was painful. I didn't make a meeting for 5 years. I had an elderly mother who was growing more and more fall risk. Barack Obama was brand new in office and the economy was crashing and crashing and crashing. I was trying to maintain a business. I let that go and I let meetings go. I just left the rehab and I just went back into life. And what happened was my restless, irritable discontent started back up again. And I didn't make a, as I say, I didn't make a meeting for 5 years. And in those 5 years, I grew to an asshole. You could not talk to me. If you asked me, hey, Matt, how you doing? I'd say, what's that supposed to mean? What do you mean by that? Get away from me. This is who I became. I became what we call an untreated alcoholic. It's trendy and gauche to say, hey, he's a dry drunk. That's a cute way to put untreated alcoholism, which is, for all intent and purpose, drunk without benefit of the drink. Restless, irritable, discontent, untouchable. You can't work with me. I'm uncooperative. You are under my skin every single second. Get out of my face. That's how I live my life. And I found myself one evening making dinner, and I was going into convulsions. And it's a behavior of mine. I never turn my back on the stove. I never turn my back on fire. But I turned my back on the stove, and if you can see me, I was doing this. Yeah, dang it. What the heck is going on with me? I was convulsing. I was contracting. My abdominal muscles were contracting. My facial muscles, my hands, my arms were contracting. I was going into convulsions. And I looked up, and on the side of, and this is God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I looked on the side of my mother's refrigerator, and I said, as if it was yesterday, there's a pizza coupon thing, a watering schedule, an old trash schedule, and a corner, right there, the corner of an AA schedule that's 10, 15 years old. And I'm in convulsions, and it dawned on me, Matt, get back there. But my brain says, no, I'm not going back there. It's the club we don't want to. It's the non-organized organization we don't want to belong to. But I knew in my heart of heart it was my relief. It was, I just went, and I had the thought, this thought almost verbalized. I need to get back to recoveries. I need to get back to people. I need to get back to the people like me, not normies, but like us. And, and I was disappointed. I was bummed out. I'm convulsing and I'm bummed out and I'm looking at the schedule and I'm disappointed because it's old and the phone number, maybe the phone number is good. So I called the phone number and I swear I might have talked to Brett. If you come into the program, you'll meet Brett. And I told him what was going on and he said, where are you? And he said, man, I wouldn't be you for 4 minutes. Go east on this road, north on this road, east on this road, and slide in right next to, slide into the Christ Lutheran Church, 3830 West Delary Avenue. If you leave now, you'll make it. It was a Friday night in March. And I turned off the fire on the stove, and I told my mom, I gotta go make a meeting. What? A meeting? Are you gonna drink again? No. It was yesterday. Anyway, I went east and north and east and slid into the parking lot. I slid into the very end pew. If you come into the program, you'll meet Catherine. I slid right in next to Catherine, and she looks at me and goes, hi, I know you. So, yep. She goes, where have you been? I said, well, I've been away for 5 years. Well, my name's Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and I haven't made a meeting in 5 years. And you could see it in her eyes. She didn't say it, but you could see it in her eyes. Why? So this is why I'm saying, don't do this. Don't do what I did. This is a cautionary tale. If you are an alcoholic, if you are an addict, get into this. And this is hard. I hazard to give advice. Because wise men don't need it, a fool won't heed it. But if this is you, if you be alcoholic or addict, you found it. You found a life raft. You found a boat. You found us. All crazy. But we're not all crazy at the same time. So, anyway, I found that meeting. I slid in next to Catherine, and it's as if she went and grabbed four guys and said, get them a book, get them a shirt, get them a schedule. Get him a sponsor. Get him going. Because this knucklehead hasn't been here in 5 years. And he almost drank, and he's impossibly inside out. And it took some time, me coming back to meetings. And I just had to commit to it. I would almost go home and stare at the wall until the next meeting. I wasn't going to drink, because my detox story is pretty harrowing. And we don't have time for it now. But the point is that when I came back in, nobody judged me. You could see it in a couple of people's faces. Why would you go 5 years with no meetings? This is foolishness. But I came back in. I've been here ever since. 17 years is just a number. I'm going to share briefly about life happening while sobriety is obsession. Life happens to me between times when we're hanging out. I quit smoking in sobriety. That was a bit. I quit smoking by means of the patches, the transdermal patches and the lozenges. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, see, I had cycled through addiction, compulsion, obsession to alcohol. And I applied those same principles, same toolbox, the same principle of serenity, the same principle of turning my will and my life over to the care of God with regard to tobacco. And took 94 days. It was a 90-day cessation program. And I selfishly hung on like an alcoholic. I kept those patches on for 4 more days. Boy, I'm going to make sure this works. But quit smoking in sobriety. I have had 2 hernia surgeries in sobriety, and we're going for a third. I just talked to the doctor today. It was a virtual visit. It was a telephone call. They call those virtual visits. And he asked me, was there any activity that you did that helped with the belly button rupture? I said, yeah, puking for 2 years at the end of my drinking career. Puking every day for 2 years. He went, oh, we're going to schedule you. So, at any rate, there's going to be 3 hernia surgeries, and I've developed skin cancer in sobriety. I'm going to go in for my 30th lesion. These didn't happen during my drinking years. These happened when I was a kid. 6, 7, and 8 years old. We grew up in spending summers in Santa Monica, Venice Beach, and the Venice Pier. And when I was a kid, we didn't use sunscreen. We used tanning oil, so we based it. We didn't protect ourselves. And every summer I cooked. I didn't ever tan. I just boiled, blistered, and cried. And so in my 50s, I developed no less than 30 lesions of skin cancer. None of them malignant, none of them carcinoma, all of them, none of them melanoma, all of them carcinoma. So my point is, life happens while life is in session, while sobriety is in session. Built and lost a business in sobriety. There's a chance I may build it back. I'm some years older now. So when I look back on 17 years, it's not 100% 17 years of happiness, but I wouldn't trade a day of it because, I've been blessed in ways that, I couldn't have imagined. And it's often said, and I heard this when I was in recovery home too. I need you to write down what you think your life will look like in 10 years of recovery. And if I had done that, oh boy, I would have sold myself so short. Things have happened to me that, I would never have believed could have happened to me. I've stood in places and seen some of the most beautiful things on the face of the planet. 4 out of 5 years, I got to go to Big Sur. And the first year, I participated in a 25-band, 3-day concert, and I played in 5 of the bands. That's my first year in sobriety. That would have never, never happened, because I would have been pushing up daisies. I would have had a marble pillow. But if that friend hadn't come by, if life hadn't happened, if recovery hadn't happened to me, if I hadn't been open-minded, willing, and honest with myself, and I feel like I take no pride in it, but I want to point out that when Joan sat there across that kitchen table from me, and she said, "Matt, I see something happening to you that causes me great distress. I love you, and I love your family. But you're becoming an alcoholic." And I said, I think you're right. And that started it. That started the greatest adventure of my life. You're in it. You're all stars of my adventure. I chaired at a meeting last night. I chaired for good. This is why I'm kind of hoarse tonight. We got together, it was an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at a church, and I was in front of an image of the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'm not going to get real religious or anything, chapter and verse or anything, but there is a chapter and there is a verse, and I shared this last night. It's in, and you can look it up if you want, I'm not saying you should, but it's in 1 Timothy, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 7. Where he says, and this is the Lord talking, "I did not give you the spirit of fear. I gave you the spirit of love, kindness, confidence, and boldness." And I put this to you. I challenge you in your recovery to bind fear, because it didn't come from God. And if it didn't come from God, guess who it came from? And so we're going to bind that. And I challenge you. I admonish, this is a good word for challenge, to be fearless, bold, confident, and loving in your recovery. I get choky here. Because there's a fellowship that waits for you. I'm looking right at the recovery home. There's a fellowship that waits for you that loves you and understands you and wants to help you and will not put things in front of you that you can't do. And when you have problems, you can turn to us. We have resources and we have ears to hear you. And so, I think I'm probably just going to go ahead and pull up there. It's been an honor to share my stories with you and thanks for calling me today, Two Beer Jim. We clarified some things. We got some things squared away. And so anyway, thanks a bunch. I love you. My name is Matt and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks.